Welcome to the week in IndyCar on the Marshall Pruitt podcast presented by Cooper Tires. We have one of my favorite people, and based on the amount of questions that came in, one of your favorite people too, Michael Schenck. How you doing, my brother?
Good, man. Favorite people. I'm pretty special. I feel pretty special there.
Well, I've been told I'm special my entire life, but it was usually said with a wink, like, yeah, okay, we know about that. So, in recent weeks, actually for a little while now, I've been doing a separate cold open of my own before rolling into our guest. But this week, honestly, it's a bit of a crazy busy week, and from a time and efficiency standpoint, I figured I'd just share a couple of quick updates here. We're recording this Wednesday morning, California, early Wednesday afternoon, where you are in Ohio. Looks like my wife and I were going to be going in for surgery next Tuesday. That's the current plan. It's changed so many times I've lost count. But in theory, we will finally and thankfully be starting this process that really locks us into a fairly regimented thing, Mike, that you and I have spoken about, where after weeks and weeks and weeks of going from one doctor to the next and interviewing folks and things going up and down, once we actually can get into surgery, then we kind of click into a real set schedule of recovery. Not trying to overshare here, just trying to let folks know that maybe, in theory, I'll actually kind of know what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis after my lady is recovered and healed. So some positive news there, and good folks like yourself and many others have been making sure that there's a lot of positivity here in the old household, because just great folks like you and others.
Well, you know that all of us wish her the best, and you guys through this, it's something that is a horrible thing to deal with, but sounds like you guys have your head around it pretty well, actually.
Well, I got my head around something instead of my head up something, so I guess that's also a positive thing. Learned this morning and just filed the story that Piers Phillips from team that you have a technical alliance with, Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports, has left the party line as he has left for another job. Piers, Sam Schmidt, Taylor Kyle, who's replacing him, and just about everybody is not answering their phones. Not a surprise. Sam sent me to voicemail, I think, after two rings on Monday, one ring on Tuesday. So I guess they're not one to talk about this, but let's start there. And I know this isn't your team, Mike. Obviously, again, you have a technical alliance with them, with your Meyer Shank Racing IndyCar team. But when you hear about a general manager either leaving or being fired, someone else within the team stepping up, knowing that you've managed your own team and been around teams for a long time, what comes to mind first? Holy cow, or all right, you know, not a major rocking of the ship?
Well, I think instinctively we all say holy cow at first, because it's just sometimes you just get hit in the forehead with it and you think, holy cow, I mean, did I know about this? Did I not know about this? I can tell you this, you know, I like Piers a lot. I think we got on really well. We had a lot of common ties to sports car world. He had a lot on his plate last year, especially with the stuff they all went through with Robert. So I have to say he'll be missed. I would think so. I haven't had a whole conversation with Sam Schmidt about this yet. My deal is together but kind of separate. As you can imagine, my shop is over in Columbus, Ohio. We have people going back weekly, back and forth weekly. We have a very open relationship. I'd sit here and tell you right now, I don't think it'll affect our program too much. Taylor and I were just at a wedding for my crew chief on the IndyCar this past Saturday.
Wow.
So we were together this past Saturday, know him very well now, and good respect for him. Young guy that's getting an opportunity, which I like. He learned a lot, I think, from Piers, and, you know, it'll be interesting to see where it goes now. Part of life, unfortunately, but always a little shocking. Always a little shocking.
I know from a Taylor standpoint, someone who's, you know, come up from the absolute bottom. I mean, I think his first interactions were something along the lines of changing suspension on IndyCar two-seater or something like that, and has just truly worked his way up, And then inside the Schmidt organization has just risen. I believe he will be the youngest general manager / team manager in the series as well, but someone who has earned his way upward, someone whose, I guess, respect within the team, I would say, darn near unparalleled, too. And I'm not saying that there aren't many others who are respected. Just when I think of someone to promote from team manager to general manager, instead of trying to go out and hire another peers-type person from somewhere else, I can't think of a better decision, knowing how much Taylor means to everyone at Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports and how much they feel like, man, this guy is just us. He's everything about us that's good and going in the right direction.
I think a couple of things. I don't know. You probably know this, but some of the listeners may not. You know, Taylor Kyle has had especially kind of hard way to go. His stepfather for over 20 years is Mike Hall.
Yep.
Okay, and you know, you think about that, and Mike didn't believe in the nepotism thing and didn't give him anything at Ganassi's. He's never worked at Ganassi's, which I actually didn't know until this past Saturday, and so that makes it kind of even doubly hard, right?
I would say so. I mean, that's you know, you think of David Donahue growing up in the shadow of his famous father Mark Donahue and trying to live up, you know, become his own man. Derek Hill, his father, Phil Hill, and I realize that's on the driving side, but, you know, if you think of someone coming up in the sport and then working towards a management role, having Chip Ganassi Racing Managing Director Mike Hall as your stepdad, yeah, that's I'd probably be wetting myself a few times if I had that standard to live up to.
Yeah, a lot there, but, you know, in despite of all that, here we are. He's going to be a GM, really, right?
Yes.
And so it's all possible out there in racing.
Well, as I mentioned, you've got a lot of questions from folks here, so let's dive into those.
Sure.
Only other thing that really jumped out to mention was, and I'm not sure when the story is going to go up on Racer, maybe today, maybe tomorrow, but we've got a number of teams that are testing on Monday. And basically some folks are really trying to get in the last bits of on-track activity of 2018 going on. It sounds like you're counting that cash there, by the way.
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's all good, man. As long as those are hundreds instead of ones,
yeah.
You're in good shape.
Handing out that per diem. We're testing next week at Daytona. So.
I wish we were talking about your number 60 MSR Honda IndyCar. That would be all kinds of awesome.
I'm sorry, but
all right.
Okay.
All right, so the last thing we do before we jump into questions is we pick my favorite question from the previous week and ask that kind person to send me a DM with their address and T-shirt size, and we'll send you a new Marshall Pruitt Podcast, the Week in IndyCar T-shirt, courtesy of our friends at TorontoMotorsports.com. And I would say, Daniel Kincaid, your question to Simon Pagenaud of how much fun it was to drive that Honda Odyssey at Pikes Peak and how many big moments did he have, that, I think, was the absolute star conversation starter from last week. So, Simon, yeah, if you didn't get a chance to listen to last week's, Simon, that's a harrowing tale. I almost need to write that up as a separate story. It was so funny. So, Daniel, send me a little note here on Facebook, a DM or something. Give me your T-shirt size, and our friends at Toronto Motorsports will get you hooked up. All right there, Mr. Shank. We have bunches of questions, and you have a race team to run, so we're going to try and get through as many as we can, as usual. And let's start here on Facebook. Let's see. First one we will go to Don Gregory. He says, this one's for the two of us. He says, boys, what are you hoping the next evolution, the new IndyCar, will look like in 2020? So give me a wish list of aero and power plant improvements you'd love to see. Just a quick little note there, Don. We're expecting to have new engines in 2021, new chassis in 2022.
That's right.
So what are you thinking, Mike? What comes to mind if you're sending good old Jay Fry your wish list of things that are cool or awesome or going to help the sport?
Well, let's just talk, and it's, I guess I say cliche, but it's not. I mean, safety is what I'm thinking. You and I combined have had too many friends that have gotten pretty hurt in these cars at different times, and the air about IndyCar racing is that it is an extremely dangerous thing to drive. I would like to try to work on that a little bit, and I think the start with the cockpit visor,
yeah,
or whatever, the aero whatever screen, you're calling,
yeah,
that's right. I think that's a great step. I'm not particularly happy about how it looks on the car, but I'm really happy about what I think it can do to help our pilots out, you know.
Yeah.
And and if you look at the flip flop that the IndyCar or that the Formula One car has on it, I personally like the visor better from an aesthetics point of view and certainly a safety point of view. I hope we go that way, and it sounds like we are, Marshall. From a power standpoint, I'm like anyone else. I'd like to have a little bit more, you know, and I know we're going to get that. So I think an increase in power by 100 horsepower will be good. I still want these things to make noise for me personally, so I don't want to lose that part of what we do. Although I know our whole world is going hybrid electric and all that type of thing, I get it. But this is, you just asked me personally. So, and it's in regards to the looks and everything, you know, I'm okay with the way the IndyCar looks now, especially in road course trim. I think it looks a little, for me personally, you know, in speedway trim, I would like to have some more space to hang some sponsor emblems on. You know, you look at our rear wing on the speedway deal, man, it's just it's a little beanie back there, you know. But listen, a nice evolution of what we have now would be nice for me, a little bit more safety for me, and a little bit more power for me.
I'll throw in, Don, two quick things. One, I'd love to see the nose just a little bit higher, feeding the keel with more direct air tends to only be a good thing for efficiency and also making downforce off the bottom of the car. Visually, that's the only thing left over with the DW12 mic in this new 2018 Universal Aero kit that they couldn't change. That's the tub. It's baked in, but that's the only thing to me that just stands out as a little bit meh. So if we could raise the nose a little bit, I think the car would look better in general. And then the other thing I would say, Don, since we know IndyCar is going to more power, and we have a pretty strong feeling there, I'd say the biggest change I'd like to see with the next chassis is a significant reduction in weight. This DW12, like me, it's a bit porky. It definitely could go on a diet, and it has only gained weight year after year after year. So I would say that while boosting horsepower is going to be awesome, as you know, Mike, hey, if they can shed 100 pounds off of the engineless tub, if they can take some significant weight off of the car, since the DW12 just drastically missed its targets from the outset, that right there is the equivalent of a lot of extra horsepower, a lot of extra speed, nimble handling in corners and whatnot. So there's one way to attack things to get more performance, that's turning up the power. Great. Can also get that by actually putting the thing on a pretty heavy diet. So I'd say if we can come out with that diet plan, this thing's going to be extremely fierce. So let's go to Thomas Gross, who says, hey, Mike, how does a joint team ownership work? And this being in reference to your bringing on our man, Mr. Meyer, earlier this year.
Yes.
One of the great announcements of the IndyCar season and also IMSA season, too. He says, does one partner make all the racing decisions and the other handles the other parts? Is one a silent partner? How does it work?
Good question. Jim is a fan, first and foremost, of IndyCar racing. He's from Indianapolis. He lives there today, currently. And he wants to learn. He's still an active CEO at a very, very large company that's very high profile. And he's focused on that. So pretty much, as we go today, you know, I run the operations. I kind of always consider myself self an operations guy first anyways. And he helps a lot on the marketing side still, and introductions and networking. He has a tremendous reach in that department. And also, I think, a really good business mind, which is nice for, you know, my wife and I when we're sitting here reviewing financials and he sits in with us. I mean, his take on it is fresh. And we appreciate that because, you know, we're so diehard shock absorbers and spring rates and performance, and you know, it's nice to have someone to say, okay, here's what I see based on how I look at financials for any company, and why are we doing this? And you know, but for the most part, he really lets us, you know, he doesn't want to operate it, especially now that he's still current. I think we'll see him retire someday in the near future here, and he'd like to be more a part of what we're doing. You know, we want to expand this program to be a full-time entrant first and then go to multi-car second. Just to, you know, we bought our second car last Friday, and we're not expanding to two cars, but we are preparing for two cars someday. So real happy with progress there.
I love the sound. So you'd mentioned, we'd spoken earlier, maybe, I don't know, a month, 2 months ago, you'd mentioned that there were plans to buy that second car. What's the general timeline, Mike, for getting that sucker in one piece, getting it on track, shaking it down, and at least making sure it's pretty and ready for when it's needed?
So this car we just bought, we're targeting using it for the 500. That'll be its first voyage. So actually, the first time it'll go out will be the April test day that we'll have at the Speedway. So it'll be a shakedown kind of run in, and then we'll bring it back in. We're going to run our current car at the Grand Prix and then use this car to be our Indy 500 car so that we can rub on it as much as possible. I'm more worried about bump day than I've ever been next year. I think we could have, you know, another couple cars at the minimum that we got to all deal with. So now we're looking at potentially 3, 4, 5 cars not making it. So that stresses me even today.
Well, I'm not laughing because it's funny. It's just when you mentioned the stressing you part, that's something that you do. And I guess it's been part of your formula of success that you're not a guy who's like, yeah, we'll be good. You're someone who sweats stuff even 6, 7 months out. So, and for those, we get this question every now and then. It is that we didn't get it this week, but maybe you can fill this in again since it's a related topic. Why buy a second chassis dedicated just for the Super Speedways? Why not just use the same car you'd race, will race during the Indy Grand Prix? What are the advantages and benefits? And share with folks how surprising it is as well.
What we need to do, what's the biggest disaster for us is not to make the Indianapolis 500. And so we start thinking, you know, the day after the 500, how do we get in a better position to perform better for the whole month? And one of those ways is now this is serving a couple purposes. I mean, once we get through the 500, that car becomes kind of a spare car for the rest of the road course races that we're going to do. But really what it allows us to do is make sure that gearbox, those uprights, those axles, the body fit is absolutely the best we can possibly make it. The underwing, you think about how much time we put into underwing fitment, and there's a lot to it. I mean, a lot to it. And I'm proud of how we did it with Schmitz this year in those kind of departments. But we didn't have great qualifying performance. We had a pretty good race day, but we want to have a better qualifying and not be in jeopardy. And, you know, we try to be preemptive with that. We know we got to be better, and this is just the very start of that.
And so this is really an exercise to have a car that's not only dedicated for the Super Speedways, but obviously Indy is the first big one on the schedule, but to have a chassis that is made as aerodynamically perfect as possible. And we're not saying that a road course, street course chassis is an aerodynamic disaster, but the amount of time that you spend trying to get the fitment right on the body, every seam blended perfectly, nothing sticking out in the wind by a little tiny bit. I mean, it's spending months and months and months trying to make a car perfect, since Indianapolis is by and large an aerodynamic exercise. It's also one of the reasons why you see teams get so upset, you know, quick teams or teams with potential get so upset when they have a crash during practice. They can get the car back out on track in a short amount of time, but what they often end up losing is that perfect body fit. And it's right. not a surprise that same car often returns to the track and is all of a sudden a mile an hour, mile and a half an hour slower, and it's simply because you don't have that aero perfection. So
yeah, that's a big point there.
Let's see. Let's move to Brandon Clark, who says, with the tight restrictions on testing, could a team use an older chassis, say an IRL Dallara or a Panos DP01 Champ car, and mount present-day aero or suspension components to it and extract any meaningful information at a private test session? The really quick answer, Brandon, is no. The differences are too great. I mean, I'm sure Mike and I over a weekend with a bunch of wood screws and power tools could, you know, fit the DW12 floor. And, you know, we could Frankenstein an old Dallara or a Panos chassis to carry everything on the current DW12. But, you know, everything about it is different, you know, down to the tub itself, which is going to give you different aero data, different downforce, just different everything. So, unfortunately, the only way to find out how to make one's DW12 faster is to do it with a DW12. Let's see. This, Corey Matthews. I like this. It's a bit of an open-ended one, Mike, and we'll see what your answers are and mine happen to be. Corey says, what is the one thing you loved about this past season that you hope carries over or can be replicated?
This is an easy question to answer. There is not a better feeling in my life when I looked up with, don't quote me on this, I think there's six laps to go in the Indianapolis 500. We were P3, almost enough fuel to make it. We make a decision to go for it. Jack goes from P3 to P2 in turn one and has a run on Wilson. And we can't make it on fuel. That being in contention for that race, I have never felt my heartbeat beat out of my body more than that moment in time. And we've won some cool races in our world here, you know. And that feeling right there, knowing what is right at your finger, to be in that position in the next 5 years, you never know. It's so difficult. This year we almost did it, and that feeling is something that I can't describe.
Corey, I'll say, I mean, the one thing we all hope would carry over is Robert Wickens' incredible ascension to, you know, look like a championship this year was going to be out of the question. He was sixth in the championship at the time that he had his crash at Pocono, so a title was a little bit out of reach at that point. But boy, I'll tell you, and I know Mike would agree, and I think most people would agree, if Robert was uninjured, I think we would be going into 2019 thinking that guy was going to be giving everyone else the business going for a championship. So that's the thing that I wish we could carry over. We've seen some videos from Robert lately, showed us that, you know, he has some occasional twitches and movement in his legs, and we hope, again, all those things reconnect and start, you know, giving him the ability to control every aspect of his body at his will. Don't think that's going to happen, you know, anytime soon to put him right back into a car in 2019, but we are certainly, for those of us who pray, we pray, and for those of us who share positive thoughts, we do the same thing. I would say this, knowing that Robert continuing his ascension next year is not really on the cards right now, Corey, I'd say the dynamic of the old Lions and the young Lions fighting hard. I mean, Scott Dixon, 5 championships, right? He's closer to 40 than he is 30. Dixie coming away with a championship. Young Alexander Rossi. Petered out just a little bit towards the end. But, man, again, I think we're going to have a pretty awesome dynamic, Mike, next year and for however many years Dixie wants to keep driving, where we got the old boss and some of the young kids wanting to be the new boss, just scrapping like mad and making a lot of unforgettable races for us to enjoy. Let's go to a Jonathan Irlon, who says, here's one for Mike. What are the chances of AJ Allmendinger being in one of your IMSA cars or Indy cars next year?
AJ has told me that he's kind of done with Indy car racing at this point in his life, and doesn't have a real desire to do it. So I respect that, and I just feel horrible for him that, you know, he could have easily won the 2013 Indy 500 without his belt coming undone. And that's tough for him, but I respect it. For IMSA, yeah, absolutely. We'll have him back now. Whether he'll be back in the car Next year or not, I don't know. But going forward in the future, I will definitely try to find a place for him over time here for sure.
4'2" of fury.
Yeah,
J.J. Allman there, boys and girls.
Yeah.
I love that guy. And he, that guy just makes everyone around him better and happier. Life is pretty darn good there. Let's see. Question here from Jim Johnstone, a little bit more in depth. It says, for Mike and Marshall, if they open up IndyCar to multiple chassis manufacturers someday in the future, how would that impact the costs of running a team? And would you see multiple chassis builders as a positive or negative for the series? And then asks a second question after that I'll get to. What do you think, Mike? If you could choose a pick, you know, a Swift, an Areca, a Ligier, a Dallara, a whomever, would you like having that options like you do in sports car racing? Or do you think IndyCar is better sticking with one supplier when it gets to its next car?
This is you and I probably are going to disagree on this, Marshall, but I'll tell you what I think. As much as I loved those days, whether I had a Renard or I had a Lola or you know a Swift in the heyday here, it's better economically for a team like mine to have one controlled chassis. I'm just telling you what the truths are, the realities are. What if you guess wrong? So what about the guys in sports cars that bought Ligiers instead of Orcas now? They have boat anchors,
yep.
Right? And I can't afford to take that chance. I'm just shooting straight, right? So from that perspective, from a financial survival perspective, from people that do this for a living and nothing else, I hate to say it, but the more spec chassis helps us.
The thing I hate, Mike, is I agree with you. That's the thing. You know me, my listeners know me. I'm all about, you know, variety and tech and cool and you name it. All the things that create, you know, human beings don't wake up in the morning saying, I just want to have the same thing every day. No difference, no variety. This is the one instance, and it's probably because I know the IndyCar economics, you know, of most teams far too well. I'm with you. I hate to say it, but you and I are absolutely in agreement here. I think if we had that situation where, hey, we decided to go with chassis A, but, man, chassis B is the one that is really kicking. But I know that there are too many teams that would be unable to respond and ditch their boat anchors, go to the ones that are needed, especially in a timely fashion, and with the somewhat precarious state of some sponsorships and B2B relationships. The thing you can't afford is to have an off half season, even, because folks are going to say, okay, I'm not even holding on with both hands. I'm holding on with one. And now you're telling me that we're on the wrong chassis. I'm out of here. So I hate to say it, but absolutely agree. Jim also asks, he says, what are we missing with the road to Indy today compared to the heyday of Formula Atlantic? And how do we bring that back? And you've got a couple of questions similar to this, knowing your history as a junior open-wheel team owner and driver. He says, I remember watching the Formula Atlantic Championship on TV and following it as closely as I followed CART. What do you think, Mike? What is either the road to Indy as a whole, or maybe just Indy Lights, since it's really the big jumping-off point? What do you think they need?
This is a true mystery to me, Marshall. And I spent 10 years in Toyota Atlantic grooming guys, right, and trying to get people to move up. I don't know what is not moving the ball enough in those series. I don't know if it's because there's too many steps and not direct enough, but I think it's economics at the end of the day. I mean, I think you and I have talked in the past. There's some guys that have enough money to get into an Indy car nowadays for at least four or five races. So, like in my case, you know, so Jack Harvey, you know, we have enough sponsorship to run at least a partial. They'd rather do that than deal with a full season of Indy Lights. Economics, there's just not enough money to stay on the vine to ripen that long, right? So, I don't have a great answer. I wish I did. I don't know why. It does feel like it's dropped off. You know, back in the day, we had Toyota Atlantic and we had Indy Light, and we always had a little rivalry about the best way to spend your money. And we had some really good years in Toyota Atlantic, and eventually Indy Lights won out over everything. But it doesn't seem like it's effectively moving enough people up in. And the Mazda thing going away now doesn't help, right? So I'm not sure. I wish I don't have a total answer there, Marshall. What do you think?
Well, I think dollars and cents is really what I keep hearing is a limiting factor. And I would not say that Indy Lights is outrageously expensive, but it's more a question of, like IndyCar, hey, you need to adjust either your schedule, the vehicular costs. You need to make whatever necessary changes to suit wherever the market is. I realize that in theory, folks would love to be the market at zero, where it costs nothing to go do this, but if the average person is saying, hey, you guys are asking for 900 grand or 1.1 million, and most people are coming to you saying, I can do six, I can do seven, that tells me that, do we need fewer Indy Lights races? Possibly. Do we? What is it that we need to do to adjust the market to fit what folks can afford right now? As you well know, the market's cyclical. It goes up and down. And
yeah,
if you just kind of stick in the up position and do not adjust when it goes down, you start to lose car counts, you start to lose championships. We had another question from someone who asked, was inquiring on the topic of Michael Schenck Racing and its past in junior open wheel and now today with Meyer Schenck, about any interest in trying to get back on that ladder, start something, be it in lights, Pro Mazda, you name it.
I love the idea of doing that for sure. But the reality of my situation is, you know, I'm a factory supported sports car team on the IMSA side, and between the IndyCar, the top line big car program on the open wheel side, and my sports car program, I can't physically expand much more and really keep the quality that we want at it. So for me, for now, I have to focus on this with an eye toward talent, though. You know, you think about where talent's coming from. The thing that Wickens did this year is woke up a lot of the United States here about some guys in sports cars. So when you look at Philippe Nasser, you look at Robert Cummins, Philippe Nasser, Colin Braun, Dorani, there are some people in there that probably deserve some opportunities. They just had to get it a different way. Look at Brendan Hartley did, right? Now he's in F1, but he was a year ago, he's at Daytona in a sports car. And before that, I mean, he drove PC cars for Peter Barron 4 or 5 years ago at Daytona, right? So I think if you really have talent, it will rise to the top and you will get a chance. But how you get there now, though, is the tricky part.
Let's jump over to, let's see, why don't we go to Daniel Davidson? He says, as your team grows, and the day comes to where you can do both full-time, would you like to see more IndyCar / IMSA shared events, or would that stretch you pretty thin, having to have MSR in two different paddocks at many, many events?
It would stretch me thin. It would stretch me thin the way I'm currently staffed, and we have almost 20 full-time people here now, and another 12 that come on the race weekends. I like Detroit. I like Long Beach. I think those are great events, which are really good for our sponsors. So I would stretch me thin, but it wouldn't be the end of the world. We would work it out. I can't, on slightly the same subject though, Marshall, and you wrote about this or talked about it. I think it's very interesting putting NASCAR and IndyCar on the same weekend. And there's going to be all kinds of opinions about that, and I get that. Two demographics, all this stuff, right? But there's something very compelling to me about that event, not just the race, but that event, what could happen with that. And so if anything, maybe something outside, way outside the box like that would be interesting.
The Indy 900. We do the 500. then we, what do? We roll in all the cup transporters, hopefully turn on the lights that are by then installed at IMS, and run the Brickyard 400 at night. I don't know if it's going to improve the crowd for the 400, but I mean, heck, that would be a real bang for your buck. And then maybe we close it off with the Red Bull Air races, you know, at 2 a.m., 3 a.m., et cetera, et cetera. So, anyways.
I mean, think about what you just said there. I mean, that is almost unfathomable, what that potential of that event could be. I just... I don't know. Maybe that would put the ball back in motorsports' hands again and get people back coming to us. You know, it's just outstanding.
Next one's less of a question, more of a statement, but it's pretty darn cool. This is sent in by Brian Mang, and he has a nice photo here of the two of you. Definitely at the end of the evening at Petit Le Mans a couple weeks ago, IMSA season finale. And Brian says, not really a question, but I wanted to point out that I caught Mr. Schenck at the end of Petit Le Mans taking out the trash. He says, I think it says a lot about his character that the team owner was doing the grunt work after a long day. Congrats to him and your team on a podium finish. And I think Brian raises probably one of the key points where I've always had such an affinity for you, Mike, and I think so many people have an affinity for you. Yeah, IndyCar team owner, IMSA team owner, yeah, your name's on the side of stuff, blah, blah, blah. There's no ivory tower in your world, and look, your team just put in a crazy long, hard day, as did you, but, you know, what are you doing? Are you kicking your feet up, drinking a beer in the transporter? No, man, you're taking out the garbage. I think that's one of the reasons why folks connect with you so heavily.
That's nice of him to say that. I don't think I'll ever be able to change that button that happened back in the early 90s when I was just trying to survive and drive race cars, and I can't seem to stop doing it. So it's a little ADD kicking, but I want to be a part of it. I want to show the guys that I can and willing to do every single job in the place, and I think it sets a good example for everybody. Believe me, we're far from perfect, but I am trying to create a place here that I could come and work at. I'm not always successful, for sure, but we certainly try.
Adam Smith says, Mike! Exclamation point. How close is the team to venturing out into IndyCar on a full-time basis? And then also asks, what's the biggest difference between an IndyCar weekend and an IMSA weekend, in your opinion?
We're close. I mean, we're gonna do 10 next in 19, which I'm really proud of, being able to increase that by 4, and that comes from AutoNation and SiriusXM. So we'll get to 10, you know, and we're the year after that. We're really trying to do the whole thing. So time will tell. The first 6 months of this year, we got to run well of 19. If we can run well and get reasonable results, I think we have some opportunity to do that. You know, that's a great question. You know, I got to tell you, the biggest thing on the IndyCar is just we're not on the track a lot. So it's so different than what I'm used to. You know, we only have approximately 2 45-minute sessions on Friday, typically, one practice and one qualifying on Saturday. And then a lot of times it's just the race on Sunday, right? So you have to be so much more prepared because you can't afford to lose any track time. And you got to have A, B, and C plan on what you want to do car setup wise. So just way more organized, very, very difficult. I can't stress to everybody how tough and difficult these drivers have it in IndyCar. You have a car that's very difficult to drive even when it's good. And the window between advancing to the top 12 and not is always less than a tenth of a second. And we work hard. We were so close to advancing at Sonoma, and I got really excited because we bumped in there in the last 10 seconds. We bumped in there, and I missed Jack to tell him to pit, and he did an extra lap and then took the checker twice, and I got fined for it. So totally my fault. Got super – what I'm trying to say is that it's so tough to do anything really good in IndyCar. When you do it, it's just a little elation. And I hope people can get a sense of that when we run these things around any track in the U.S., you know.
Let's see. We've got a little bit of a follow-up here or related from David Zitterbart. It says, Mike, at the start of the IndyCar program, you said you wanted to be a two-car full-season team. How far away is that? He also asked us how the season's shaping up for IndyCar's full-season car count. But obviously, you mentioned buying the second car. It's going to be dedicated as your Speedway hot rod next year, doing 10 races. But crystal ball, tell you whether two cars full-time is feasible, 3 years, 5 years? And what do you think that second car would be? Is that hire someone, or would you be open to taking someone bringing a budget to you?
We'll be open to any of the puzzle pieces it takes to get a proper program on the track with the right people. We're open to it all. I would think that's maybe a 2021 thing, maybe. If I'm looking down, I'd like to do one full-time really well in 20. But, you know, just opportunity comes along, you know. Just opportunity. So we just announced a big Caterpillar deal in sports car right now, and that was a great opportunity that Jackie Heinreicher brought to us. And, you know, things like that come along, and you try to capitalize on them when they do, or position yourself to be looked at if they do. And that's what our target will be. We want to position ourselves to be a team to be with, whether it's a sponsor coming to us or a driver that has a sponsor come to us. We'll be open to most of that. But what I don't want to do is overcommit and not be able to get to everybody's expectations. So that means taking a short deal and trying to make it a long deal. That's where the wheels fall off the cart.
Yeah. Well, and that's another thing you have done, and you've been, I would say, another area of respect that's due to you, and it's the, all right, we have a desire, we have a plan, we know how to make this thing crash and burn before we even achieve it, or yep. We can do the somewhat uncomfortable thing of locking ourselves in to gradual growth and really sticking to it. And that's the part where, and look, I've been guilty of you know, trying to achieve way too much in a too short amount of time and just having nothing but, you know, burnt ashes left over from that stupidity. It is cool to see that you know how to make things fail. So rather than do the things that could trigger that happening, you want to make sure that you get to where you want, even if it takes longer than maybe you are comfortable having to live with.
That's right.
Let's see, where should we go next? Someone asking about a fire when Gustavo Yachman drove one of your cars. And luckily they asked the track, because without that it would have been a very open-ended question of which event when Gus lit something on fire, you name it. Let's see, William Mattson, this is a great one. Hi, Mike, how happy were you when you realized that you could change your team's name to Meyer Shank Racing and not have to change your MSR badges?
I was very, very happy. That's a great question. Made me extremely happy, and it worked out incredibly well. Didn't mind Meyer coming first at all.
Well, that works out okay. This one comes in from Tom Pendergrass. And any advice for someone who aspires to start and own a race team at some point in the future? All right, now that's one you're certainly perfect for here. Give us a couple. Be sure to do this, and a couple, man, steer clear of these ones.
The problem with owning the team is, unless you're independently wealthy, you have to take extreme risk. And what do I mean by that? That means you have a job somewhere, 9 to 5, and then you try to start a team, like in IMSA somewhere at the lower series, and that's great. The problem comes in when you have to make financial commitments in order to grow, and you're not positioned to do that, and you end up. Potentially, like we did, mortgaging our house, things that are really, really risky, right? And the difference is the person that can take a calculated risk or not. And we took risk every time severely, but we were calculated the whole time. We understood what our upside was and what's our worst case. I always look at the worst case. But you're going to have to be willing to take a financial plunge that you don't want to do, okay? Now, how you do it? For me, whether you do it on open wheel or in sports cars, you have to gradually come into it. But you got to get some key personnel on your side that you can help sell. So, for instance, if you have an engineer that you're friends with that wants to kind of do his own thing, but he has a name and a resume that someone could hang their hat on and decide to come to you, that's one way to do it. Meaning, I'm owning this team, and my engineer is my partner, and he did this the last 3 years. He's got a great amount of experience with this Formula 4 car, right? And we'd like to start our own team, and we're going to do it because we think we can do it better, and I've got a guy with a lot of experience, and you entice people to come to you. You know, so you're going to start out in series that fathers and mothers and fathers pay you. So you got to do something for them to come to you, okay? And that's basically how we started and worked out of it from there.
Let's see. I got one here, and this is, I enjoy this since, as I think my listeners know, I cover IndyCar and sports cars full time, so it's kind of fun when I get to speak to a pal who runs in both paddocks as well. Let's see. Craig Tomastick says, first, very excited, like many other fans, to hear that Catherine Legg, Anna Beatriz, Simona Di Silvestro will be sharing a ride in the IMSA Endurance Rounds next season with the hometown team. Craig asks, how did this deal come together? And you'd mentioned Jackie Heinricher earlier. Any chance we'll see them in an additional car at non-NAEC rounds, such as Mid-Ohio? And for those who don't follow sports cars full-time, that last question might be a little bit sensitive to Mike, because that was originally the plan this year. One full-time Acura NSX GT3, one for the four endurance races. And then Kat did so dang well, that turned into a, all right, well, we're going to go to another, we're going to go to another, and that manifested into two full-time entries. So, I don't know, man, you seem to have really lit interest with folks with the really cool lineup you have surrounding Jackie's Caterpillar-sponsored car. So, how'd that come together, and you think we might get to expand it a little bit?
Sure, sure. So, Catherine was a driver coach for Jackie a couple of years ago, and they met then. And Jackie and Catherine had talked about this deal for a while. Jackie's been working on it for, I think she says, almost 2 years. And so Catherine brought Jackie to me in the mid-year or so of this year, just to have discussions about, you know, what do you think you could do with this deal? And it kind of went from there. Jackie and Catherine are the two scheduled full-time drivers, and then Bia and Simona will come in as their schedule allows for the course of the rest of the races. That's the plan as we sit here today. It's an incredible opportunity for my team. I think what Jackie's done with Caterpillar and the women's initiatives that are going on globally for a lot of different companies, just not Caterpillar, are very important issues, hot button issues. You know, this will be a third season in a row with me. So I think the one thing that Catherine has said to me, and I just, for some reason, this rings true to me, is she said the car doesn't know who's driving it, whether it's man, woman, or child. And whoever's doing the job is doing the job. So I appreciate that. And I've learned a lot with Catherine, and she's incredibly intense. And to me, I hate to segregate her out as a female driver, because I really don't treat her that way. I treat her, I get mad at her, I'm happy with her, you know, all that. But having said that, to me, in the world, in our global world, Catherine is the top of the female drivers right now in approach and attack and all that. So I'm just proud to be a part of it.
We have more than one question, and Craig also asks this, more than one person inquiring about Kat, knowing that her sports car team owner is also an IndyCar team owner. We've had a couple of folks say, hey, so there's this leg driver person who's really good. Could we see her in a Meyer Shank IndyCar? And Craig also, you know, expanded out saying, you've got three former IndyCar drivers coming into your team for Daytona. The gears turning it all in your head, and do you think, I don't know, man, just looking to the future, could that be something either for Kat or any of the other women you're working with?
Well, here's what I can tell you. Everything is on the table. Anything is possible, and that's what makes this such a cool deal. So time will tell, but you can imagine that's not the first time it's come up.
Sponsors, go ahead and dial 1-800-FUND-CAT. That would be a pretty awesome thing. All right, this is an interesting one. It's definitely not necessarily related to your team, but you're a person who's pretty honest about input. Howard Bennett says, question for Mike. As a team owner, any thoughts or comments on the this week's extraordinary Italian court ruling against Santino Ferrucci and his father, brought by his Formula 2 team, and the whopping $575,000 sum the court has ordered to be paid to the team? Have you ever had to deal with something like that within your own program? And I wouldn't ask you to name names, obviously, but you got a driver who either owes you a lot or maybe has been put on the hook to pay someone else. That's a little murky, right, man?
Yeah, so here's the thing. I have not been litigated in 25 seasons of doing this. Now, I'm knocking all over my head wood, right? but here's what I can tell you. I live and die by the contract. I do what I say I'm going to do. That's in writing and then some, okay? If they don't perform, if whoever I'm in contract with do not perform, we're going to have a big issue. They have to do what they say they're going to do. And then if it becomes an argument and the courts decide, well, that's on you then, Bub. That's on you. So for me, if you go into business with me, we're going to come to an agreement. We're going to shake hands, and we're going to have some paper to sign. And we're going to abide by that like it was the Bible. And if it goes outside of that, then we'll do what we have to do to protect ourselves.
Let's see. Let's dive into a few more. All right, we've got a question. Some clown sent this in on Facebook. Guy named Jack Harvey. Not sure I have heard of this guy, but looks like a genuine monkey. Jack Harvey asks, what's your favorite part of working together? And I love that there's an assumption that there's a favorite part of working with him.
Yeah, who said anything about good times?
No wonder you drink so heavily. No, I mean, come on.
I got to stop doing it. I did get Jack to drink a Busch Light at the wedding last weekend, so that was so epic. Oh, yeah.
Well, I guess you're starting as American as can be. All right, kidding aside, it's hard not to love Jack. I mean, he's got that little, you know, wagon tail puppy demeanor. He's pretty darn good in a race car as well. What do you like about this kid?
There's lots, but I'll tell you this. This is an example of the ladder system working. So that question we had about six questions ago, Jack is a shining example of a guy that did very well, spent 2 years there, two years, and deserves his day in the sun. So he got a little bit this year. He's going to get more next year, and we'll see where that leads. This is how the system is supposed to work. So I'm super pleased that Jack gets that, and he gets to make a little bit of money at the same time, right? Like it's supposed to be, old school. Now, and what people, you know, what people draw people to Jack, he is so good to every single person that's outside when he's outside the car. So immediately you feel drawn to him. The girls love him. He's a good-looking guy. He talks well, speaks well, and he's intelligent, right? So he's a, you know, AutoNation and Sirius love him. When he does events for them, you know, and that's the kind of package you need. What we need now next year is we need to advance our car. We need to get some results and get the whole thing to come full circle here. And there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do that.
Well, we're going to overlook the fact that you're talking about Jack's package and move on
we'll go to something else.
So we've got, I'm going to do some select choices from Facebook here, then move over to a couple of questions we got in on Reddit, then a few from Twitter, and then we're going to let you get back to running your race car team there, Mr. Shank. Jordan Darwin sent in a couple. He said, Mike, what is there to do around Columbus for a racing fan with some hours to kill? And our pal John Sable said, like shop tours at MSR? ?
Sure. I mean, you know, we do that. The problem is, you know, we're just in and out so much, you know, but when people do come, if we have time, we're happy to show people around. We keep a fairly low profile around here for some security reasons, but, you know, we're always happy if we can to show people around our shop. That's usually never a problem. And we try once a year to have an open house. We haven't scheduled one in 18 because honestly, we're just so damn busy racing. So we are going to get a date on the calendar soon and announce that over the social channels, and certainly hope people will come and see us then.
Let's see. Ryan Terpstra says, Mike, you run cars in IMSA and an IndyCar. Many fans, myself included, by the way, suggest Road Atlanta as a potential IndyCar venue. I think it would probably be a bit too dangerous. I do as well, but I'm not afraid of danger when I'm not in the car. What do you think? Road Atlanta too crazy for an IndyCar?
It would be extremely high speed, and I love Road Atlanta, so I wouldn't mind it at all. And I can tell you, just from having, I don't know how many people we had there, Marshall, 60 or 80,000 people there last week or 2 weeks ago, I think the market could take it and would do well there. So I'm for it, and I would authorize it. I would okay it.
All right, let's see. John Sable there, who responded to Jordan's question, says, Mike, during the preseason podcast we did where I had you and the three other new team owners together, said, you noted the jumping through hoops nature of procuring all the parts needed to build an IndyCar from a dozen different suppliers. John asks, a year on, knowing that you just bought a new car, has IndyCar made any improvements to this process?
They have. And I can tell you, this is a good question, actually, because I remember having this chat. The car is totally whole kitted, ready to go. We don't have to wait for any parts. I think it was just a process of Dallara getting caught up, and they simplified their order process a bit Okay, so it is a little bit better. But of course, me doing my second one, I've got a file, you know, 4 inches thick of exactly where to go to get the fuel cell or the brakes or the wiring loom, that type of thing. So it's just a little easier. I'm just telling you, from a new guy coming in, it was more difficult than, say, buying a Cadillac DPI car. I'm just giving an example.
John also asks, or says, Marshall, it's been 15 years since we lost Tony Renna, and I'm curious if you could shine some light on who he was. He says, unfortunately, the quietness surrounding his fatal crash at Indy has spread to the man himself, and considering he was a young American driving for an important team like Ganassi, it's a real shame. I'll actually open that up to you as well, Mike, because, you know, Tony was coming up the open wheel ladder while you were, you know, still running your own very successful open wheel ladder team. I mean, I remember Tony as just a young, hungry American, one of a handful that I thought had the goods to move up to IndyCar and be a success. Can't say whether he would have been a champion again, one of those things where, you know, unfortunately he was robbed of that opportunity to find out himself. But I just always thought of Tony as a young and hungry guy who was fighting like mad to make progress and was making progress. And that's maybe a little bit different than some that seem to come in, breeze their way to the top, and have an easy time of it. What do you recall about Tony, having run in the same circles?
Well, yeah, he was doing Indy Lights when I was in Atlantic, I want to say. So I didn't know him really well, except for a good driver that was hustling hard to get a deal. And when things go down, like, and he finally got that with Ganassi and stuff. I just know a lot of people that knew him. And tragedy, man. Again, you know, I don't want to go too far off on this tangent, but there's just too many of these guys that have we've lost because it's kind of similar things and similar problems in the car. And I just would like to stop that, you know. And this is a guy that deserved his opportunity. He was going to get his opportunity. Who knows where he'd be today? You know, I don't know. Let's keep working on that safety side of things and limit this going forward here.
This next question from David Nixick, it's one that I think you blew people's minds in our preseason new team owner podcast talking about the price of a set of dampers.
Yeah.
David asked me, he says, Marshall, you gave us a tutorial on dampers when talking about the Harding team. Can you tell us anything about why there are repeated references to the superiority of Penske's dampers? I guess first thing to mention is a lot of teams win without using Penske's dampers, so it's not as if they're the only ones to have, but there's kind of the obvious thing here, and that, you know, Mike, I know you saw them come in as well, is, you know, Penske Racing shocks, though they were not only a customer-available thing you could buy on many levels, you know, to fit all kinds of cars back in the day, but this is Penske starting his own damper company, making sure that while there are customer things available, there's also been the, call them the custom for us, Penske dampers. They haven't always been the best, but you know, if we look at today's models, they are known as being made out of unobtainium, you know, the super lightest things possible, and just, you know, like everything else Roger does, the ability to zero in on every performance area of the car and make it as much of his own and their own as possible, that's been one of their keys to success. And so, you know, there are no, quote, Dale Coyne dampers. You know, there's no Hunkos dampers. There's no Shank dampers. You think about Penske, they have an idea. They make it. They test it. They perfect it. It's their own because they have the resources to do it, and it's, you know, 20-plus years old, so it's a lot of history there as well. But tell us from your end, Mike, having to come in and learn about IndyCar's crazy damper world. What should I buy? Should I try and get Penske's Olean's? What should I do? What's that process been like for you, and maybe even singling out one brand that maybe seems like it's the hot trick to have?
Well, that's the thing. Everyone's doing the proprietary things now, for the most part, everybody. So you can start with a body of an Olin's like we do, and then you go off on your own tangent for there. To me, this is the biggest waste of money on the planet. And unfortunately, only myself and Dale Coyne feel that way. And it's because everyone else thinks they get a big advantage because of this. And I would say all the way up through 2017, Penske dominated. But you saw a lot of different winners on street. Let's take the roughest roads that we go to, right, which is Detroit, Long Beach, street courses, right, where Toronto, where damper control really comes into play first. And, you know, other people won besides Penske. So when we switched this aero package, they lost a bit of their advantage. They're still dominant in the category, right? They still have the best damper program, probably without question. But other people have opportunity in this narrow window we're in right now. Eventually, Penske will come over the top with something that none of us can have, none of us can buy. And I just don't think it lends anything to the show. You will see spec dampers on our car, or I should say more of a spec damper, right, in the near future. In the meantime, you know, the fans that come out and watch us, they don't know that I've just spent $500,000 developing these things all year. It just doesn't matter.
Well, true. I mean, I can't disagree with the general premise. I just know that even if we go to a spec damper, that same amount of money is going to be spent in some other area. I mean, the one of the truisms that we've seen as spec racing or spec-ish racing has become the norm is a lot of things get taken away in the name of cost savings, fewer test days, fewer open parts on the car. The one thing I've seen, and I think we've all seen, is it hasn't saved, it saved money in that area, but it's opened up in other areas. Okay, so we can't go to the track as much as we once did. Well, what do? Simulators. Sim programs, you know, we're on the 7 post, we're in the wind tunnel. That same money, if not more, has been diverted to off-track testing. So, can't disagree that the costs are crazy for dampers. I just know that it's kind of a throw-the-dart situation where, all right, you take this off the board, it's going to creep somewhere else.
Well, here's the thing. It's hard to argue with that, and I get that, because we'll go try to do something else. All I can do is base this on my experience at higher-level racing. In Daytona Prototype, when we had fairly spec-down things, you couldn't use inerters, you had a very spec-down, you know, four-way adjustable shock maximum, that type of thing. All I'm saying is that we're more opportunity for people to do well, okay? And, okay, fine. So it closes down the shocks and opens up another area. That's obviously can very well happen. Based on my experience, if we get a little tighter, more opportunity will come for more people.
Amen.
That's all.
All right, I'm going to grab one more from Facebook and then move to another platform. I'm going to grab another one here from Jordan Darwin. I like this. This is the last question that came in on Facebook. Jordan says, Autosport posted a video on YouTube this morning placing some of the blame of Alonso's lack of a full-time IndyCar program on lingering bad blood in Honda Japan about his notorious, quote, GP2 engine comments about Honda's F1 engine from a few years ago at Suzuka. Have you guys heard similar rumblings in the paddock, and do you put much stock in that train of thought? I'll gladly take this because I've been covering this thing a lot, and I can't reveal all sources and all of everything, Jordan, but I will say that I will absolutely put my stake in the ground and say this Honda angle that's been emerging in the past week or so since Alonso said he's not coming to IndyCar next year full-time, and McLaren said they're not coming full-time. I'll put my stake in the ground and say this Honda stuff, it's a red herring. It really, truly is. Was there reticence, if not outright pushback, from Honda Japan when they were asked if they would fund and support this McLaren / Alonso initiative? Yes. Was there a, no, we're not going to be your backers for this thing. I've been told that's absolutely the case. Was there a, and this is the part that's kind of taken off, you know, in recent days, Mike, and was there a Honda also saying, and to hell with you on engines and don't talk to us and go away and et cetera, et cetera? I have been told that's not the case. Have I been told that there was a strong suggestion that it would be smart to talk with Chevrolet and see if they could be a service provider? Yes. But I've never heard anything that has said Honda, through Honda Performance Development, would not supply, would not lease an engine for Fernando Alonso to use. or McLaren to use if that's where things ended up. And that's a lot different than Honda somehow has been the monkey wrench that has stopped all the gears in motion and prevented Fernando's dream of becoming a full-time IndyCar driver. He was pretty straightforward in saying that coming here full-time in 2019 was never really his thing. I'll also just throw in quickly, Mike, I think I'm fairly confident that if Fernando Alonso rang Chip Ganassi and said, "Hey, I hear you've got a seat available next to Dixon. I'd like to be in it." I think Fernando Alonso would be in that car. And obviously, Fernando knows he would not be receiving a paycheck like he does in Formula One, the size of what he gets there. But if Fernando Alonso reached out to any team of serious competitive capabilities and said, "I'd like to be in your car full time," tell me if you agree, Mike, but I think most teams would trip over themselves to try and make that happen. So Honda, yeah, I think that's a complete red herring, Jordan. There are too many other things that I know happened, including goals in May of, "Hey, it looks like the McLaren Formula One chassis is going to be pretty good. It's moving. It's going to get there." And then they got out of May and found out that, no, actually, we were worse off than we were last year. And upgrades aren't doing anything. That's when we heard about Zach Brown getting his chain yanked hard by McLaren's board of directors. And a, hey. We always said getting into IndyCar was contingent upon the F1 program taking off. We knew that there was hope that this new Renault-powered car was going to get us there. But we're being confirmed on a weekly basis that it ain't there. If anything, we have taken steps backwards. So put this distraction aside. And that's what's happened. Michael Andretti was also telling us, you know, look, there's a deadline coming up. I'm not so sure, et cetera, et cetera. So all the indicators that this wasn't going to happen has been around for a while. And again, none of this, to my knowledge, is really falling at the feet of Honda for happening. If I'm wrong, then I've had a lot of people telling me false things. But I think a lot of folks, Jordan, have just been adding things up in a convenient way, trying to find the one thing that it could all be pinned on. And I don't put a whole lot of stock into any of that. All right, Mike, let me grab a couple here from Reddit. We'll grab a couple from Twitter and bid farewell to this episode. Let's see. This one actually comes in from our pal Michael Swope from Reddit, who is one of the leaders of their IndyCar group. And this one's for me, but I'm also going to expand it out to you. It says, "Marshall, it's always a great day when I'm lucky enough to get to go to IMS for some on-track IndyCar action. As a member of the press who spends a lot of time at the track and gets to see stuff up close frequently, does that feeling of magic ever die when you enter the track or when you hear cars running as you approach the track?" Hell no, Mike. Hell no. It
never does.
No. And maybe barring one or two tracks that I'm just not a super fan of, I actually have that kind of childhood feeling of excitement and rush of possibilities just about every track that I go to, in IndyCar, sports cars, whatever. There's just that feeling. And it's, you know, I guess without it, or if there's a point that I don't feel it, I would have to say, all right, time to do something else in the world. But no, it's still just as strong, love it just as much. And, you know, it's home feels like home, obviously, but it's also a weird sensation, Mike. Maybe you feel it the same way. Tracks like Indy and Long Beach and Sebring and so many others, they're remote, but they also feel like home when we're there, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that feeling never, I mean, if it goes, then I'm probably out of racing at that point.
Mike also asks, "What's my daily driver?" Well, that's really embarrassing. It is the 1999 Mitsubishi Mirage I inherited from my wife, that my wife brought into the relationship. I call it the Silver Ghost because I make a point of driving it every year down to Monterey for the Historic the Reunion Car Week, where it's nothing but trillion-dollar Aston Martins and Lamborghinis and Porsches. and I love having this old, dented 19 horsepower shitbox that just, it is the worst thing ever that barely makes it up the hill. But I'm also in the midst of work with my pal Taz Harvey to try and find a slight upgrade there before he moves out.
That's good to hear.
And I only put, funnily, I only put like 1,000-ish miles a year on it. We have our main family car that we use, my wife's daily driver. But yeah, the reality is I don't do a ton of driving. I'm either in the office working or, you know, remotely somewhere else working at a racetrack. What about you, Mike? What's your daily hot rod?
I have an MDX Acura.
Ooh.
And that I drive. But I also, truthfully, I have an NSX that I adore and love. And I bought that when I wanted to show Acura I'm a company man. And it is the best automobile I've ever had.
Well, I am jealous. That sounds a little bit better than my Mitsubishi Mirage DE. Let's see. All right, I love this question. This comes in from Reed Alf. It says, hey, Marshall, let's say we live in an alternate universe, and the 20th annual Hawaiian Super Prix is only a month away. Do you remember that, Mike, when they announced the Hawaiian Super Prix? It was going to be a $10 million race. Oh, my God. And it went nowhere. He or she says, who does IndyCar invite as wild card drivers, and who is your pick to win it all? Huh,
wild card would be bringing Paul Tracy back.
Ha!
That would be awesome. And see what he can do out there. He would try pretty hard, I promise you that.
Mario as well. I think Mario, he was the big name touted with the original ones, so I think Mario for sure. Who would win it among...
you know who that would be.
It'd be Scott Dixon.
Of course it would.
All right. I mean,
if you bet against him, you're really asking for it.
Damn you, Dixie. The stuff gets a little bit predictable.
I know. I know you hate to say that, but the guy is ridiculous.
I can't stand that guy. He's the worst ever. Got a couple other great questions here from Reddit that we already got to through ones that came in from Facebook. So let me jump over to Twitter, Mike, grab a couple more, and thank you for a little bit of overtime here. I know that, again, you probably got to go polish that beautiful NSX or do something more fun there in the sun. Here we go. Great question from Eli Hoopengarner. Says, Sir Shank, that's good. We're going to knight you. This question could have been asked before, but did your involvement with the Acura NSX and IMSA point you towards running with a Honda-powered team in IndyCar? Or was SPM the key factor, regardless of HPD affiliation? So a little bit of stuff to clean up there, Mike, why don't you go ahead and take that?
100%. That's exactly why. I'm in the family. HPD, Acura, Honda are all run under HPD. And everything we do to develop all the engineering in the background that my engineers work with HPD engineers to develop the NSX, all of that made 120% to be Honda. So that came first, and then we worked on the team thing second.
Max Radke asks, have you been able to leverage your success in the IMSA series this year into any additional sponsorship for your IndyCar program? And he also asks, what's been the biggest barrier to securing a full budget for your IndyCar effort?
Well, selling IndyCar, IMSA, NASCAR is always extremely difficult, and it always happens because of relationships typically. Not only do we have to have a product to sell, but it's the relationships of the people between me or Jim Meyer to the people that we're going to. And that part of it is what has led to where we're at today. If you look at it, we have Honda Acura, we have Caterpillar, we have SiriusXM, we have AutoNation. I say this to you, I'm very proud, and I think we're one of the most heavily sponsored teams across both boards right now, and I'm really proud of that. And that is because of how we treat people.
And I'm not saying this just to throw in sponsor plugs, but I think you're also being polite in not mentioning all of them. Even some of the smaller ones, you know, the Rock Fork folks and the this. And I mean, you've got a number of, call them associate sponsors, that have been with you for a while and have placed their faith, whether you're doing a Daytona prototype or a LMP2 car or whatever. You've had some others that aren't necessarily the bigger names we see in some of the cars today, but they've also stuck with you.
Well, that is absolutely the truth. And for years now, we're talking about Curb Records, we're talking about Rocky Fork Company, Cap Fixtures. which did our glorious garage at the Indy 500, and we'll do it again next year. And Robert Service Group. These three or four companies have been with me for 8 to 10 years, and no matter where we ventured, they were right behind me and pushed me forward. And without them, and especially a couple of years, without them, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about these Fortune 500 companies that are all part of us. Those smaller companies make up my lower backbone, right? And without them, we crumble, and we will always have them involved in our company.
CM16 asks, Mike, do you miss the IMSA prototype class? Maybe you want to field an Acura DPI as well, question mark?
I miss DPI fiercely. And we will be back there in the near future. But we have a job to do with the NSX, and we will do it, and we will do it again in 2019. And I really look forward to trying to get the championship this time. But we want to get back to prototype, and we're going to try everything we can to do that.
Rounding up on something we spoke about earlier, Jeremy Ghosh asks, when are you planning to do another shop day? open shop day, I should say.
Yeah, we're going to do it. I just can't make any promises. We're going to do it on a Saturday sometime, and it's up to my wife and I to she orchestrates all that, and we're trying to create the Saturday to do it. Literally, we have had 3 days off in the last 6 months, and I am going on vacation here about a week, Marshall.
You heading down to the Bahamas or something?
I am. I'm going to the Bahamas. I'll be in the Exumas for a week, so good. I look forward to that. Yeah.
Next question here, very important, critical one, comes in from Ed Haynes, who asks, Donatos or Massey's?
Massey's. I grew up with Massey's, so it has to be Massey's.
So what tips Massey's over Donato's for you? Because, you know,
they have bird seed on the bottom side of their crust, Marshall.
Bird seed.
I call it bird seed, and it is glorious. It is glorious. So
culinary advice from Michael Schenck.
Yeah. It's pretty simple.
Yeah, Don Davis says, Mike, I'd like to get your team owner opinion on a few things. Would you like to see IndyCar go back to burning methanol? And would you like to see the series return to steel brakes?
I love the smell of methanol, but it is dangerous stuff. So I'm 50-50 on that. Steel brakes. I feel like the carbon brakes are mostly under control now. And certainly I wasn't around when they had so much problems with them at the beginning of the DW12 era. For me, they seem fairly stable, so I'm okay them being on. And I don't feel, by the way, that I'm spending excessively on carbon brakes in IndyCar right now. I spent a lot more, for instance, Marshall, in 2016 with my LMP2 car.
Yikes. Yes, I recall you mentioning how ridiculous that was. Okay, we've got two questions to go. Alan Cradler says, more of a technical question for you. What are the reasons IndyCars do not have power steering? Cost only to separate the best drivers? And also says, would it hurt the on-track product or would it be not noticeable for fans? I'd say it's just more of a historical aspect, Alan. Power steering's just never really been part of the program. And, you know, it certainly serves a benefit when we're talking about crazy downforce, hard to turn the steering wheel, and or hard to turn it consistently, something that might fatigue the driver over a long race. But, you know, I think it's also become one of the points of pride where we have never seen IndyCar drivers more fit, with more muscular endurance, cardio endurance, than we do right now. And we're not talking about they have to just be super swole up and look like cartoon characters, but we see some very, very, very fit race car drivers, and it is due to the fact that even with the reduced downforce that we have with this universal aero kit, this thing still is going to burn your forearms out, your biceps, your shoulders, you name it, if you are not tuned up physically. And I like that. I like the idea, Mike, that a car as fast as this, as fierce as this, it's not. There's nothing about it from the cockpit that makes it easy to get all the speed out of it. There's no anti-lock brakes. There's no traction control. I mean, you're having to give all of yourself to get all of the car's capabilities out onto the racetrack. Do I think it would hurt the on-track product if power steering was added in? I don't know if hurt would be the word, Alan. I would say that we've seen that when the car has had an outrageous amount of downforce, there were some drivers whose skill we knew was not particularly close to those who are the best, were maybe closer to the best than they would have been without that blanket of downforce comfort. I would say if you then take away the physical demands as well, so that anybody, in theory, could drive an Indy car at its peak for hours on end, I would say that would just be another thing that removes the separation between what makes a pick their names, Power, Rossi, Dixon, etc., immense talents from those who we know wouldn't normally be able to play in their hemisphere. What do you think, Mike?
I agree practically with everything you said. So there you go. I'm with you.
All right, last one here. Bit of a fun question. This comes in from Tim Falkowitz. He says, what if IndyCar were to one-up NASCAR in the gimmick department? Go to an oval / road course like Charlotte or Homestead, and during the race, alternate doing a lap on the road course and then a lap on the oval. How do you think that race would turn out? All right, Mike, as someone who's had to pay for crash damage or bill for crash damage, what comes to mind of one-lap oval, one-lap roval, on and on and on and on?
The first thing that flashed in my mind was a crazy eight race, figure eight race, in a bill that you can't even fathom. There's no possibility of that ever happening.
I would just say, since we have the attenuators in the back of the car, maybe we could mount, a carbon fiber ball hitch to then carry the little, the little caravan behind it.
Yeah.
So we do have kind of, proper IndyCar figure eight crash 'em up races. Tim, I love you, man. This is a great question. I think that the race would have to be decided on the last car running. Actually, that would probably be it. There would be one winner and only one person on the podium, because there'd only be one vehicle left, because everyone else would run into one another somehow, because keep in mind, if you get folks that are lapped down or et cetera, you could have some folks finishing their oval lap while others are diving off or coming back onto the oval from the road course. So it's crazy, and I love the idea. I just think this might be more of a slot car IndyCar race than an actual real-world race. Granted, who would love this more than anyone, Mike? Dallara.
They would come out on top.
25 new Dallara DW12 sold on Monday following the oval roval race. Well, Mr. Shank, thanks as always for taking some time. Just really cool to see you continuing to be one of IndyCar's and IMSA's most popular team owners, knowing that you're not exactly out in the world trying to get folks to love you, and you're not chasing attention. I just love the fact that folks seem to realize they have one of themselves with you, and try and link up with you on that level.
Yeah, man. I appreciate it and always want to help when I can here. Always be here for you.